Good evening. Welcome to Beijing Diary. This is Evening Fort with a Ukraine update for May 7th, 2022. And actually, it's already, I say evening, it's already morning where I am, after midnight. Today I want to talk about Russia's expansive territory, because I was talking last time about the moral confusion, and as I said, much of it coming from, in fact, I think most of it coming from the right. And I've even heard, what was that conference, AIPAC, what was it? I'm not sure, but anyway, I heard people saying, Putin, Putin, you're cheering on Putin and cheering Russia. That's quite disturbing to me. But, you know, I was just thinking about it after I after my last podcast. I had mentioned that I responded to a tweet by Candace Owens by saying, you're historically challenged. So then I thought, well, what is the history that they're missing? So I want to share a little bit about that with you before I talk about the current situation. In 2005, I traveled to Xinjiang. It's called Xinjiang in China. It means a new territory. I flew to Urumqi, and then I took the train 24 hours across the burning hot Taklamakan Desert to Kashgar. Kashgar is the westernmost city in China, and it's an old trading post in Central Asia. And in Kashgar, I stayed at the Simon Bingwan. Bingwan means hotel in Chinese. And behind the Simon Bingwan, there was, they had set up some rooms as sort of a youth hostel. They didn't really have a regular international youth hostel in Kashgar, but they'd, you know, they understood backpackers are coming through, and so they'd set up some rooms just sort of as a hostel, as a separate part of the hotel. And I stayed in one of those rooms for 2.5 weeks. 25 kwai a night, and I don't know, it's about $4 or $5, I suppose. And in that 2.5 weeks, people would come and go, you know, people from Korea, people from Israel, people from, there was a guy there from Scotland, I think. I mean, just different people coming and going. And I watched them come and go for 2.5 weeks. And behind the Simon Bingwan was the old Russian consulate. And you can go to the album on my Facebook page. I created an album for my trip to the Silk Road to Kashgar in 2005. And you can see a picture of that Russian consulate in just mint condition, just like it was yesterday. And I believe the year on it is 1890. And then if you you travel, go across the city to the old Chinibai Hotel. You go behind and see the old British consulate. The Brits and the Russians were watching each other. They both regarded Xinjiang as neutral territory. The British called it, referred to it as Chinese Turkestan. And they wanted, to be under China, because the Brits would not want Russia to control it, and the Russians would not want Britain to control it. And actually, neither one of them was interested in Chinese Turkestan or Xinjiang. They were both interested in India. That was the prize. So this was called the Great Game. The term Great Game was coined by Rudyard Kipling. Rudyard Kipling was a British expat who basically grew up in India. I can't remember what his parents did. I don't think it was an MK. I can't even remember. But he was a third culture kid to grow up in India, and he coined this term, the Great Game. Now, I'm going to read to you a description of this Great Game and Russia's expansion. This is from Peter Hopkirk's book on the Great Game. This is, now remember now, this is the end of the 19th century. The Russian threat to India seemed real enough at the time, whatever historians may say with hindsight today. The evidence, after all, was there for anyone who chose to look at the map. For four centuries, the Russian Empire had been steadily expanding at the rate of some 55 square miles a day, are around 20,000 square miles a year. So think about that. 55 square miles a day, every day, for 400 years. Is this a country that's interested in swallowing up territory? Well, some may question that extraordinary statement. This was made not by me, but by Peter Hopkirk. So let me read you just a little bit about Peter Hopkirk and who he was. Peter Hopkirk has traveled widely over many years to the regions where his six books are set: Central Asia, the Caucasus, China, India and Pakistan, Iran and Eastern Turkey. Before turning full-time author, he was an ITN reporter and newscaster for 2 years, the New York correspondent of the old Daily Express, and then worked for nearly 20 years on the Times, five as its chief reporter, and latterly as a Middle and Far East specialist. In the 1950s, he edited the West African news magazine Drum, sister paper to its legendary South African namesake. Before entering Fleet Street, he served as a subaltern in the King's African Rifles, in the same battalion as Lance Corporal Idi Amin, later to emerge as the Ugandan tyrant. No stranger to misadventure, Hopkirk has twice been held in secret police cells in Cuba and the Middle East, and also been hijacked by Arab terrorists. His works have been translated into 14 languages. In 1999, he was awarded the Sir Percy Sykes Memorial Medal for his writing and travels by the Royal Society for Asian Affairs. So I give quite a bit of credibility to what he says here. Now, we know who won the conflict for the conquest of India. It was the British. But Russia has been concerned about territory and territorial enlargement. So I think that knowledge of that history seems to be very, very limited on the part of the Americans. And as I said, it's most noticeable on the right. And the right seems to be becoming more and more libertarian, which libertarians tend to be isolationists. Now, let's talk about what's happening now. I believe it's Monday is the, it's a ceremony to commemorate victory over the Nazis. And, you know, Putin has been talking about the denazification of Ukraine, which is ludicrous. Ukraine is not Nazi. And ironically, he's attacking the same cities the Nazis attacked. So he's actually doing what the Nazis were doing in his attempt to what he calls denazification. He's actually doing to Ukraine what the Nazis were doing to them. But he wants to declare victory on Monday in that great ceremony, victory over the Nazis. So the situation in Mariupol, they're determined to attack that steelworks and take over it. And, you know, so I think, and a lot of people think that they want to be able to declare some sort of victory. Now, there's some question about Putin as to whether he would, you know, if it didn't reach his satisfaction, just declare victory anyway. There doesn't seem to be a lot of integrity in the way he's approaching this. But I have heard that many, if not all, of the civilians have been evacuated. I hope that's true. There are still soldiers there, and they're determined to fight. They're not giving up. So I'm afraid it's going to be rather bloody before it's over. Now, before I say anything more, I want to talk a little bit about all the tremendous conflict that has been generated by the leak of the draft opinion by the Supreme Court. So apparently there was consensus among a majority of the court that Roe v. Wade should be overturned, and Alito has written the draft opinion, and that opinion has been leaked to Politico. So there's a lot of discussion about who might have done that, and it's being investigated. But I want to talk a little bit about that situation and how we might look at it, how we might understand it and respond to it. Now, understand, today I'm going to be talking about the legal aspects of Roe v. Wade, not the right and wrong of abortion. I will talk plenty about that. I have a lot to say about that. But I'm talking about the legal aspects of Roe v. Wade, okay? Understand, that's my focus for today. So, legally, Roe v. Wade was doomed the day it was written. It was very poorly argued and based on an extremely weak foundation. In my opinion, a completely fabricated foundation. So, let me talk about that. And now, some would say, well, you know, Eric, I mean, they pass a law, then it becomes law. So how can you question whether it's legal? But the problem is, the Supreme Court doesn't have the authority to pass laws. It's called legislating from the bench. They do not have the authority to do that. The judicial branch, the American government is three branches. The judicial, the executive, and the legislative. The judicial branch does not have the authority to do what the legislative branch does. And the legislative branch does not have the authority to do what the judicial branch does. And the executive, the same. They all have independent individual authority. It's called separation of powers. The Supreme Court does not have the authority to make laws, to pass laws and make new laws. Now, you know, they talk about making new laws, especially the sort of the liberal element. They see the Supreme Court as creating new law. They're not supposed to do that. They're supposed to interpret the Constitution. And there's some argument about that, too, about whether they're overreaching. But at any rate, if they're going to declare a law unconstitutional, they have to show that there's a fundamental basis in the Constitution that makes that law untenable. So they have to find within the Constitution the foundation for saying that the right of a woman to kill her unborn child is so strong and so clear in the Constitution that no state should be allowed to pass laws against it. And that's another thing that needs to be emphasized here. If Roe v. Wade is overturned, that doesn't mean that abortion will be legal throughout the country. That just means that it will go back to the states, to the individual states. All right? So that's the controversy. So what is the foundation upon which the Roe v. Wade was based? It's the 14th Amendment. I defy you to read the 14th Amendment. No fair Googling it now. I mean, you can Google the 14th Amendment, but not the foundation for Roe v. Wade. I'm so that you don't have to fuss with this, I'm going to give a copy. I'm going to put a copy there. It'll be under the first comment on Facebook, so that you can see the 14th Amendment there, and you can clearly see, read the amendment, and then tell me where you see a foundation for saying that a woman has an inalienable right to kill her unborn child. I think it's a real stretch, and so that's the weak sort of the Achilles heel, so to speak, of the Roe v. Wade decision. Let me read to you what Ruth Bader Ginsburg said about Roe v. Wade. I am not a fan of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, but she said one thing in her career that I really agree with. She said, measured motion seemed to me right in the main for constitutional as well as common law adjudication. Now listen to this. Listen to this statement. Doctrinal limbs too swiftly shaped, experienced teachers may prove unstable. The most prominent example in recent decades is Roe v. Wade. Doctrinal limbs too swiftly shaped, experienced teachers may prove unstable. Now, let me clarify that Ruth Bader Ginsburg is where I differ with her. I think, and I'm hesitant to speak for someone who isn't here to speak for herself, but I think she would still believe in a constitutional support for abortion, but I think she would choose equal treatment of the law or something as a foundation. What I'm saying is she did not like the 14th Amendment as a foundation for Roe v. Wade. She thought it was a very weak foundation, and very weak indeed. Read the 14th Amendment. So the legal foundation for Roe v. Wade, whatever you regard or whatever your opinion about the right of a woman to abort her child, the legal foundation upon which Roe v. Wade was based was very, very weak and, in my opinion, completely fabricated. So it was doomed from the start. But there's another thing. Roe v. Wade was not written for women. It was not written to protect children, obviously, but not even to protect women. The author of Roe v. Wade was Justice Blackmun, and Justice Blackmun was a lawyer for, I believe it was the Mayo Clinic. He was a doctor's lawyer. Roe v. Wade was not written to protect women. It was written to protect doctors, the hitmen of the divorce or the abortion industry. That's who it was written for. So the intent, the motive, everything about it was wrong from the very start. Now that's the legal aspect, okay? That's the legal aspect. I'll talk more and more about the moral aspect. I have a lot to say about that because there are, you know, this is a very, very contentious issue. And opinions are changing. So the opponents of abortion, in terms of the thoughts and the thinking of the people, the opponents of abortion are winning. Because more and more Americans I was listening to a professor the other day. She said Americans are becoming romantically attached to the fetus. When they want to keep that baby, this was a professor at New York University, I can't remember what university, anyway. She said Americans are becoming romantically attached to the fetus. You know, when they want to keep the baby, they take the ultrasound and they pin it up on their refrigerator and, you know, it's a picture of their baby. So as ultrasound develops and these images of a preborn child become more vivid, it's harder and harder for people to think of it as just a blob of human tissue. So generally speaking, the momentum is moving in the direction of a revulsion with the idea of killing an innocent unborn child. What is the ultimate prognosis here? As I said, Roe v. Wade is history. It's just on a very poor foundation. It was written at a time when we didn't have that much information about what the unborn fetus was like. The fetology, the study of the fetus, was not very advanced in 1973. So things have changed a lot since then, and it's doubtful that it could have been written the way it was then if it were written today. But for me personally, I have a strong belief that states ought to be allowed to write their own laws. When I was a lobbyist at the North Dakota State Legislature in the 1989 session, Right to Life was, at that point, was trying to get an amendment to the Constitution that life began at conception. They wanted to have an amendment to the Constitution. Well, I didn't like that. Now, you might say, well, you're opposed to abortion. Why wouldn't you like it? Because that's Roe v. Wade in reverse. That's telling the states they can't have laws against abortion. Now, somebody might say, well, heck, abortion is murder. Okay, let's talk about murder. If you commit murder, you're not going to go to a federal prison. I mean, unless you kill a federal officer or something. I think the last person executed that I remember being executed by the federal government was Timothy McVeigh. That's because he blew up a federal court building. But you just go out and kill someone. You're not going to go to a federal prison. You know why? Because you didn't break federal law. What? No federal law against murder? No. It's left up to the states. So if you want to say abortion is murder, then all the more reason it should be left up to the states, right? Again, I'm not talking now about the moral rightness or wrongness of abortion. That's a very, very important subject, and I'm going to say a lot about it. I've got a lot to say about it. But I'm talking about the legal aspects. The legal foundation of Roe v. Wade was very weak, and thus it really was doomed. Okay, guys, we've got to get going here, but I will continue this, and we've got a lot more to say about it, and I'll focus a lot more on the also on the moral aspects of this issue. Thanks for being with us, and we'll see you next time. This podcast is hosted online at BeijingDiary.podbean.com. That's BeijingDiary.podbean.com.